development that was always between Syria and it's the colonial era boundary marked by this land embankment, and they symbolically took it out. Maybe not just symbolically, I guess. Vijay Prashad, Flashpoints is easily available on SoundCloud. Just search for them on that audio resource on the web. She's with the Institute for Policy Studies, Foreign Policy in Focus, has a great article up. She's with the New Internationalism Project. It's time for me to go. I didn't do an announcement, but I also want to mention that we also thank the Urbana Market at the Square for their underwriting. More information can be had at urbanailinois.us/market. And this hour programming is supported in part by World Harvest and International and Gourmet Foods, featuring a wide selection of hard-to-find items from around the world. They're at the corner of 6th and University, 519 East University, on the web at worldharvestfoods.com, and on the phone at 356-4444. Thanks again for listening. It's time for the Labor Hour with a pretty full retinue of folks here today. And I'm over time. Thanks for listening.
Welcome, folks, to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air with listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois, and webcasting live worldwide at weft.org. Views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Bob with some underwriting announcements.
Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the Illinois Education Association Union. The Illinois Education Association's mission is to effect excellence and equity in public education and to be the advocacy organization for all public education employees. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio. And the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And this hour programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, call 217-328-2295.
Okay, thank you, Bob. We're going to be having an interesting show today. We're going to be talking about public relations and propaganda and how that affects you and how to counter it. First, we're going to be going to some news stories, starting with Bob.
All right. Starbucks came up with an announcement this week that employees nationwide will be eligible for a free college education through Arizona State University's online program beginning this fall. The new initiative, touted as the first of its kind, will allow many of Starbucks' 135,000 workers to graduate debt-free from ASU with no requirement to repay or stay on with the company. The funding will come from a partnership between Arizona State University and Starbucks. Under the program, Starbucks employees who work at least 20 hours a week will receive full tuition reimbursement if they enroll in ASU's online program as juniors or seniors. Others will be able to apply for scholarships worth $6,500 on average if they enroll as a freshman or sophomores in ASU's online program, and ASU advisors will help them apply for other need-based financial aid, including coveted Pell Grants, the university said. So it says here, quoting, "The Starbucks decided human capital is one of the most important things they can invest in." That from a gentleman at the Arizona State University. "Everybody is concerned about what are the ways to get through college." And I've read a few other things. One person said, several people said, the reason that they could offer this kind of a program is because very few people are going to take advantage of it. They said the company estimated that 70% of its 135,000 U.S. workers are either current or aspiring college students, but as some have noted, this is also a savvy PR move. Many companies offer tuition reimbursement as a way to recruit, but the benefits are used on average by fewer than 1 in 10 workers. Only 3.9% of retailer staffs, the sector that includes Starbucks, take advantage of tuition reimbursement. By comparison, 6.1% of Fortune 500 companies' workers took a class on the company, and 8% of healthcare workers generally do it. So there's other companies that are mentioning that they do the same thing. UPS offers tuition help on day one for their employees. Also, Walmart workers can study in. He says Walmart gives a 15% discount on tuition to any employee who's taking classes at an online school. Dick's Drive-In is a small little burger chain that apparently operates six burger joints in Seattle. And they've given away $1.3 million in scholarship money since it started offering
programs. Should that be Richard's Drive-In?
Yeah, about 20 years ago. Home Depot and Walgreens promises to train future pharmacists and stuff like that. But,
well, okay, now that there, that's a real deal, all right, because they need pharmacists.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All right? Right. And by the way, when I was in graduate school, and this was in the 80s, I had a class with a woman from high school who I hadn't seen for like 10 years. And she worked for Illinois Power, and they were sending her to Illinois State to work on a master's degree, but she was it's for her safety related job.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some sincere things, but this here is just taking two big issues and conflating them. And as if I remember to talk about it later, we might see that actually in Bernays' propaganda, quite often he uses an example of people wanting to shop at a place or buy products made by companies with good labor standards.
Mm, okay,
even back then.
Edward Bernays, we'll talk more about him later in the program.
It talks here too, yeah. Companies basically fall into two categories in terms of pay and the perks they offer workers.
Also scab line universities.
Yeah, those mm-hmm. that view their workforce as a cost and those that consider employees an investment. And it says basically it depends on if the company delivers quality, service, or some attribute other than low price, then they figure that personable employees are a value to their mm-hmm. company.
Well, actually, if they're
competing only on cost, then they treat their employees like dirt.
Mm-hmm. Having very literate baristas might be nice, you know.
Yeah, but that offer of 15% discount from Walmart, I mean, that's absurd. I mean, you know, $10,000 tuition, and oh boy, we're going to pay $1,500 of that. And if you're working at Walmart, you can't afford the other $8,500. There's no way.
I thought it was funny when I saw him mentioned in that story.
Yes.
Yeah. What struck me sort of along the Walmart line was the mention of helping them get Pell Grants and stuff.
Coveted Pell Grants. Yeah, I love the way they word that.
It's like
Pell Grants used to be real common. No, I mean, they've cut back on those so severely. I mean, that's like almost winning the lottery to get a Pell Grant these days. But before, I mean, 20, you know, 30 years ago, Pell Grants, it was easy to get a Pell Grant, you know?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm relating to. And also, I mean, your loans weren't, you know, maybe 15 right. grand or something when you got out. I don't know.
If even that, yeah. Okay, the whistleblower and transparency website WikiLeaks published on Thursday the secret draft text of the Trade and Services Agreement, also known as the TISA, Financial Services Annex, a controversial global trade agreement promoted by the United States and European Union that covers 50 countries and is opposed by global trade unions and anti-globalization activists. Activists expect the TISA deal to promote privatization of public services in countries across the globe, and WikiLeaks said the secrecy surrounding the trade negotiations exceeds that of even the controversial Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement that has made headlines in the past year. Demonstrations erupted in Geneva in April as diplomats met in secret for the sixth round of negotiations over the TISA, which would cover international trade in a wide range of service industries ranging from finance and telecommunications to transportation and even local utilities such as water. Protesters demand the draft text be released, but it has remained secret up till now. Public Services International, a global trade union federating public service workers in 150 countries, has reported that TISA threatens to allow multinational corporations to permanently privatize vital public services such as healthcare and transportation in countries across the world. This agreement is all about making it easier for corporations to make profits and operate with impunity across borders, said PSI General Secretary Rosa Pavanelli in responses to the leak. The aim of public services should not be to make profits for large multinational corporations. Ensuring that failed privatizations can never be reversed is free market ideology gone mad. The leak comes 2 years of the day that WikiLeaks publishers Julian Assange began seeking sanctuary in the Ecuadorian embassy in London after the country offered him asylum to evade prosecution in the United States for publishing secret U.S. government documents. Assange is also wanted in Sweden for questioning over questionable sexual assault allegations lodged against him in 2010. in which Snowden has since Sweden has refused to guarantee Assange safety from being extradited to the United States. Assange no longer agreed to go to Sweden for questioning. Back then, the secrecy of the TISA negotiations exceeds even the controversial Trans-Pacific Partner Agreement and runs counter to moves in the WTO towards greater so-called openness. The same governments that installed the failed global trade deregulation models in the World Trade Organization that led to the global financial meltdown are now promoting TISA, according to Kelsey and WikiLeaks. Anyway, it goes on here going into the story, that WikiLeaks officials announced that TISA leaks on Thursday during a press call from London. And Assange, okay, goes on to say that Assange's supporter fears that if he leaves the embassy in London, that he'll be arrested and brought to Sweden to face questioning from prosecutors. The Assange would be given a one-way ticket to the United States. In other words, they'd let him, forced rendition or whatever. Assange's attorneys say they invited Swedish prosecutors to question him at the embassy in London or over Skype, but the prosecutors in Sweden have refused. For the past 2 years, London police have kept the embassy under surveillance and stood ready to arrest Assange should he leave the building. This has cost British taxpayers $10 million, according to reports. Assange said he continues to be the target of the largest ever criminal investigation into a publisher by the U.S. Department of Justice and demanded that Attorney General Eric Holder in his investigation of WikiLeaks or resign. He also warned President Obama about leaving office with a legacy that includes extrajudicial killings, including those of Americans, and chilling free speech by targeting more journalists for investigation than all other presidents combined. It is against the stated principles of the United States, and I believe the values supported by its people, to have a four-year criminal investigation against a publisher, Assange said. The ongoing existence of that investigation produces a chilling effect, not just in internet-based publishers, but all publishers. And while in the Ecuadorian embassy, Assange said he's been busy working as a trustee for the Courage Foundation Defense Fund for NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. So thank God for WikiLeaks, and yeah. Hooray for Julian Assange. You know, if it hadn't have been for them, I mean, there's been all sorts of things revealed by their leaks in the last several years. And I don't care what the corporate media says, no one has died as a result of this. Of course, that's the thing they tried to say, that, oh, he's going to cause the deaths of American servicemen in Afghanistan and other places and who knows what. And it hasn't happened.
This agreement is more secretive than, yes. than the TPP.
Yes, huh? Yes, yes. Because what they're going to do is, I mean, they're going to, this if this goes through, the United States will never have a Medicare for all healthcare system. Right. Our current Medicare system will be privatized. And countries, Canada, Europe, and the ones that have actual a Medicare for all healthcare system, they'll be forced to privatize because likewise, just in all these other corporate trade treaties, if governments that are signatories don't comply, then the corporations can take them to court and sue them, not just for their losses, but for their potential loss yeah. of profit. Yes. I mean,
that's the amazing part about the TPP, the potential loss.
Yes. And also it mentioned water utilities. I mean, there's a lot of community owned water companies around the United States, as well as even a few, actual power companies like Springfield. All their electricity and natural gas that comes through a utility that's owned by the city of Springfield under this agreement, they would force those to be privatized. Mm-hmm. So this is another anti-democratic. Oh, and what really gets me is that this would enforce, even if there was a privatized service that turns out to be where it costs people more and the quality is less than a public service under this agreement, that wouldn't matter. That they would basically, if people tried to make it a public entity again, that they would be able to sue them and force the local government or whatever into bankruptcy as a result of the court cases. In fact, I know of three communities. One is up in the Naperville area near Chicago, and two over in Indiana that have been fighting for like the last 4 or 5 years against Illinois American Water, our water company here, because I didn't realize they had other places around the state and in Indiana
in the country.
And around yeah. the country.
They just changed the name. That water company out on the East Coast, West Virginia or whatever, that had a spill in mm-hmm. there. They were just like Virginia American Water Company.
Ah, okay.
So they
okay.
have like affiliates like that in like 20 different states or something.
Yeah,
they're massive.
It's owned by a German multinational.
Right.
But these three communities, the one in Naperville, Illinois, and two over in Indiana, they've been fighting in the courts for 4 to 5 years, and the American Water has basically bragged, saying that they're going to basically just tie them up in court to prevent them being basically deprivatized to where it will bankrupt their their communities. You know, it's just it's disgusting. It's disgusting if people, you know, especially with water. Water, as time goes on here, is going to become more and more of a precious commodity. And when you get private companies, private corporations that own a people's water supply, there's nothing stopping them from basically pumping that water, putting it in tanker trucks, and sending it to where they can get top dollar for it, and then basically ration the local community on water. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, communities should own their own water. I mean, that's, to me, that's an absolute. I mean, just like we should have our own, you know, public fire department, you know, and not have something privatized like they used to have in the old days, to where they had all these different fire departments, and if you didn't have one of their plaques out on your building, right, they'd just sit there and watch it burn to the ground if the other company didn't get there. Yeah, it's ridiculous. So what else do you have, Bob?
On a slightly lighter note.
On a slightly lighter note, yes.
Oh, wait a minute. A relevant movie, The Gangs of New York.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. It was about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, according to a new career builder survey, a majority of workers think their boss is doing an above-average job. Asked to evaluate their boss's performance, 63% of U.S. workers say their manager deserves an A or a B, while 14% would assign a D or an F. About 4 in 10 workers, 39%, say they're friends with their boss. So this was a nationwide survey conducted online by the Harris Poll on behalf of Career Builder from February to March of this year. They sampled over 3,000 full-time private sector workers across industries and company sizes. So, yeah, A was 24%, B was 39%, C was 23%, D was 9%, and F was 5%. And it says grades appear to be aligned with bosses' communication and management styles. Workers who interact more frequently with their bosses tend to rate their performance better than those who keep their distance. 31% of workers who interact several times a day with their boss assign them an A, compared to just 17% of workers who interact with their boss once a day or less. And the study also showed a correlation between positive ratings of bosses and opening communication, even if that communication doesn't take place in person. 25% of workers say their boss typically communicates with them via text or instant message. Of those employees, 30% assign an A to their boss's performance. They also had a second part to the survey, and that was requests that people's bosses put on there that they thought were kind of bad boss things. So here's one. They asked the employee to fire a colleague and then to drive them home. That's a terrible boss right there. Here's another boss asked an employee to order items on a personal Amazon account so the boss's spouse wouldn't know about it. They asked employees to like his Facebook videos. Another boss asked an employee to commiserate with his daughter-in-law about the death of her cat. Another one asked the employee to climb up on the roof to see if there were any dead birds. And another one asked the employee to coach other employees on how to pass a drug test. So those are some signs of bad bosses, evidently.
But who did the study?
Career Builder, but as they said, it was done by the Harris Poll, an online poll for Career Builder.
That's hard to believe. That's that high.
Polls are spurious at best. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to be playing some music here. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on the Supported Community Radio Station, WFT. This is Albert Cummings, and he's going to be coming to the local Blues, Brews, and Barbecue event here in Champaign, Illinois, next weekend. So here's some Albert Cummings, and then we'll be right back.
Well, it's a hard job just getting by with 9 kids and a wife. Well, I've been a working man damn near all my life. Well, I'll keep on working as long as my 2 hands are fit to use. Well, I'll drink my beer at a tavern, I'll sing a little bit of these working man blues. Well, I keep my nose to the grindstone, work hard every day. I go out on the weekends after I draw my pay. Well, I keep on working, gonna buy my kid a brand new pair of shoes. little bit of these working man blues. Sometimes I feel like leaving, I do a little bobbing around. I throw my bills out the window, I catch me a train to another town. I keep on working. Monday morning I'm right back with the crew. Well, I drink my beer that evening, I'll sing a little bit of this working man blues. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Professional compulsive consumers. That's their, they think of that as their national pride. It's their civic duty. Consumption. It's the new national pastime. Not baseball. It's consumption. The only true lasting American value that's left, buying things. Buying things. People spending money they don't have on things they don't need. Money they don't have on things they don't need. So they can max out their credit cards and spend the rest of their lives paying 18% interest on something that costs $12.50. And they didn't like it when they got it home anyway. Not too bright, folks. Not too bright. But if you talk to one of them about this, if you isolate one of them, you sit them down rationally, and you talk to them about the low IQs and the dumb behavior and the bad decisions, right away they start talking about education. That's the big answer to everything. Education. They say we need more money for education. We need more books, more teachers, more classrooms, more schools. We need more testing for the kids. You say to them, well, you know, we've tried all of that, and the kids still can't pass the test. So, oh, don't you worry about that. We're going to lower the passing grades. And that's what they do in a lot of these schools now. They lower the passing grades so more kids can pass. More kids pass, the school looks good, everybody's happy, the IQ of the country slips another 2 or 3 points, and pretty soon all you'll need to get into college is nick up a pencil. Got a pencil? Get the thing on there. It's physics.
That must have been it.
Okay. So that was George Carlin, and that was compliments of Bill Gorell. And kind of leads into a subject we're going to be talking about today, which is public relations and propaganda. And reason I've been, you know, I wanted to do this show for quite some time because Bill is actually somewhat of an expert on this. Bill, you want to talk about a little about, you know, how you sort of became an expert in the whole thing of public relations?
Well, actually, what I always wanted to do is make TV shows and movies. And I went to Illinois State University, and you can look, they are very good at teaching that stuff there, but it's not like you can really like major in it or something. And I ended up with a public relations minor, just partly because it's a really good backup. It's a people use video film for public relations, and also it's a good place, you know, to learn about writing and such like that. But that was back, that was in the 1980s. And however, I do not really see that there could be really huge changes in the field because, what I've realized reading propaganda was a lot of the things that Bernays brings up.
That's Edward Bernays, by the way.
That's Edward L. Bernays.
Okay.
And, propaganda was, published in 1928.
Yeah, just a little background. Edward Bernays, he was an Austrian-American pioneer in the field of public relations and propaganda, referred to in his obituary, died in 1995, as the father of public relations.
Very good. And along with some other people, there's some other people you might want to think of along these terms, too. Somebody I think I want to start studying more is Walter Lippmann.
Oh, yes. Interesting little fact about Walter Lippmann was that he was on the CIA payroll for a number of years.
Oh, really?
Along with a lot of other American journalists. out there to this day, actually. Remember the Judith Miller thing?
That's correct.
Yeah, back right at the invasion of Iraq and all that. But, you know, most people think this was only a sort of a condition of the 1950s and 60s. But, no, it continues. But, anyway, yeah, a little side note about Walter Lippmann.
Well, and then there was also, too, the idea that you can do really good with public relations techniques.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, see, basically what my bachelor's degree is in mass communication,
mm-hmm.
okay, which covers radio, TV, all the mass media. And so, of course, public relations is greatly related to that. My graduate education was just in communication.
Mm-hmm.
And see, what Illinois State is more of a school to prep you to go work on a PhD.
I see.
Rather than to get you deeply into one study right then. Mm-hmm. And so you end up taking a whole lot of different communications things. And a lot of them that I found that I thought would be terrible, that ended up being either very interesting at the time or much interesting later, was rhetoric,
mm-hmm.
which is old public relations, we'll mm-hmm. say that. Mm-hmm. Small group communication, very important that people get into the idea of small groups, because that's how human beings evolved. We didn't evolve as nation states,
mm-hmm.
okay? And another one, too, which I find valuable on almost a day-to-day basis working, and that's organizational communication.
Mm-hmm.
So the field of communication, of course, we're there going, well, that's what makes humans humans, because humans communicate. You know, uh-huh. Not just tool-using animals, you know,
uh-huh.
whatever. And also, too, a lot of these fields, the social sciences in general, are very insecure, all right? They want to be physics, is what they want to be,
mm-hmm.
but they can't.
Yeah, it says that Edward Bernays, I used a lot of techniques of ideas of this guy named Wilford Trotter about crowd psychology, and as well as psychoanalytical ideas of his uncle Sigmund Freud.
Yeah, and there's also Gustav mm-hmm. Le Bon.
Yes,
who'd mm-hmm. be worth checking out. He's probably one of the earliest people writing on those mm-hmm. things. And the thing about Freud, there's a famous, by marriage, he was somehow a double nephew of Sigmund Freud. Anyway, I'm going to bring in right now some of the sources that I'm thinking of lately.
Mm-hmm.
One is, you know, the public relations classes. I have my effective public relations textbook, which I've actually quoted several times on this show about the Ludlow Massacre.
Yes, about John D. Rockefeller and
right.
how he did improve his image after the Ludlow Massacre in Colorado.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. And also the BBC series by, I believe it was Adam Curtis. Which is Century of the Self.
Yeah, which was in 2002.
It's like a fascinating, and it centers a lot on Bernays, and includes interviews with his one of his daughters.
Mm-hmm.
And for more on that, I would direct you to a podcast called Smells Like Human Spirit.
Okay.
Sort of a takeoff on the famous Nirvana song.
Mm-hmm.
Smells Like Human Spirit. And they did several, actually it's this one guy, Guy Evans, he's from England, and he, within the last couple of years, had moved to the United States, but he started this in England. And he did several episodes where he read from propaganda and discussed what he read, and he also does a pretty in-depth interview with one of Bernays' daughters.
Mm-hmm. You know, what's interesting about Bernays' techniques is that not just assimilating information, but basically would use basically was a way of trying to persuade somebody, or I should say society, to do things that they might not want to do, and they appealed a lot to people's, instead of just giving them information, whether it's true or not, they did that too, but they like appealed to their emotions as opposed to their reason, more to the emotions than to reasoning.
Well, and there's another thing I wanted to bring in, mm-hmm. which this book greatly helps explain why and how these things were done on a huge corporate scale.
Mm-hmm.
And that is Taking the Risk Out of Democracy by Alex Carey.
Okay.
Which this book is available to read for free as a PDF. Just
And what's the name of that again?
Taking the Risk Out of Democracy by Alex Carey.
Okay.
And also Propaganda, Lippmann's work.
Propaganda was written by Edward Bernays, correct?
Right.
Okay.
And there's also people like Walter Lippmann. A lot of this stuff is available for free on the internet. Just Google the title of the book and PDF.
Okay.
And you're very likely to find it. Okay. Now, one of the reasons I wanted to bring up Taking the Risk Out of Democracy is that is the reason that we have so much public relations happening.
And it's because of democracy?
And that's why it happened to start around the turn of the last century.
19th to the 20th century, okay.
Right, mm-hmm. And into the 20s. Because look at what was happening during that time. Or the beginning. I mean, we started out, you know, you had kings. You know, you could just kill people if you didn't like them.
Yeah.
You know, then things started getting, the people started realizing more power, the nation states, the governments, the units of populations became much, much larger, and you were dealing with a mass at which at some point could realize that all it had to do was act.
Mm-hmm.
And in the particular history of the United States, what happened was, at first, landowning white males had the vote. And through the first, you know, let's say 100 years of our history, that franchise expanded, and kept expanding to include everybody over the age of 18, except in some states.
If you've been convicted of a felony, yeah.
So what happened then was, well, gee, we just don't have our white male landowning buddies running everything now.
Yeah.
And at the same time, the economy of the nation changed
from
being, you know, sort of the Jeffersonian yeoman farmer landowner, like to find who the founding fathers were.
Mm-hmm.
That's what many of them.
And that landowning requirement, that was a minimum number of acreage, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
I remember somebody with 40 acres and a mule wouldn't have the right to vote. It had to be somebody that owned, say, a couple hundred acres, if I'm not mistaken.
But yeah, and the founders, I mean, and even if they weren't like these plantation farmers, you know, Ben Franklin, he was a printer.
Yeah.
Had his own business. I thought it was really funny. Some really Christian person on Facebook said they wanted a president like Ben Franklin. I immediately thought of the Hellfire Club.
Okay.
But, so anyway, it was, you know, everything kept growing, and finally, and also the rise of the corporation.
Yes.
Which is sort of a mass entity, even though it might be controlled pretty much by one individual. And the reaction to the large industries that arose, you know, the mills and the mines and such, with the workers as unions, and then them gaining more access to voting. And finally, in the 1920s, finally women get to vote, which is... And Bernays, he does have a chapter on women. And, of course, he is very famous for the Torches of Liberty March, where he advised, got these women socialites to smoke cigarettes. I believe it was like in an Easter march or something like that. And it was very visible and portrayed and made it possible, socially possible, culturally possible for women to smoke.
Yeah, because prior to that, most cities and towns had basically laws against women smoking in public.
And
he kind of played on that, and then in addition, you know, for the purpose, of course, of not to give women more rights, but basically to sell cigarettes to women.
But sometimes a cigarette is just a cigarette. Paraphrase his double uncle. And he did, I guess later in his life, he did regret that and worked on anti-smoking campaigns.
Yeah, how ironic. Yeah, you know, what's interesting about Bernays, from my research, is that he felt that manipulation of the public was necessary in society, which he regarded as irrational and a herd instinct, basically.
Right. He needed to take the risk out of democracy. And if you read, see, that was something that came up in a totally unrelated article I was reading the other day, and just one paragraph where the person explained that progressives want to fix people. Okay, here's progressives, and that time progressivism was a huge idea in that generation anyway. Teddy Roosevelt, boy, he liked fixing people in the Philippines, didn't he? Wilson, who is also Glenn Beck's big bogeyman. Everything leads from Glenn Beck through Stalin and Mao to the SEIU and Acorn.
And to Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah, Woodrow Wilson. Who's some other progressives? Of course, we think of some people as progressives who probably weren't. But that Lippmann, of course, like I said, probably Dewey, you know, a lot of these other people. Mm. Another, but they were comparing that to populists.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, and saying that populists just promote what the people want.
Yes.
Okay, well, in Kansas at that time, their populists were very progressive.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really into all this free silver. And I still don't understand the relationship between silver and gold back then and what this was all about. But that was actually what William Jennings Bryan Cross of Gold speech was about. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about just money in general. It was that somehow gold was screwing over the farmers in Kansas. But I still don't understand that.
Yeah, we'll do a little research on that.
Yeah, but that's getting a little bit of a side. But what I wanted to get into there, at that time, those populists were in Kansas, all right? Look at the populists in Kansas now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, attacking abortion clinics, super right-wing politics.
Yeah. Well, so, before they were against slavery, and it was one of the first states to have a prevailing wage law, actually.
Really? That's excellent. But that's, and it was, and that's way it was, like, well, through the Mountain West, all the, like Montana had, and all those states were incredibly populous, and I believe Wyoming was the first state to give women the vote.
Yes. That's correct. And the first one to have a woman in the U.S. House of
Representatives. Right. Didn't she vote against World War One or something like
yes,
that?
Yes, she did.
Yeah. And now they're just like, oh, man.
Well, and I think this you can explain this in terms of some things of regarding you know, manipulation, public relations, propaganda. Yeah.
Okay. Now, see, much propaganda is basically what you'll read in quite a bit of a textbooks. And a little bit of background on that, what I was taught was that the theory that explains the governance of the United States is called public interest liberalism.
Okay.
And Lippmann gets, or Bernays gets into this here. You know, even though he generally talks about masses, he gets into these really long, almost biblical lists of organizations. You know, so you're not only just a part of the mass public, you're part of the Shriner public or the NRA public.
Mm-hmm.
I'm part of the laborers union public and so on and so forth. And he talks about how you really need to communicate through all these channels. And at the very beginning of the book, a conspiracy theorist will really be loving this. He talks about, you know, sort of like what I like to call now the establishment, which is the leaders of the society, the leaders in fashion, the leaders in science, the leaders in politics, and so on and so forth. And basically, it appears to me your qualification for being one of these great leaders who is the real secret government of the United States.
And those are his words, too.
Yeah, is basically being a white, at least a white-collar person who's probably wealthy business owner and powerful business owner, as well as politicians and so forth.
Who usually are come from a family of very wealthy people, yes.
Well, in order to be a member of this class, you should be able to and need to hire public relations people.
Okay.
Now,
you know, it's interesting, real quick here, about Bernays. One of his first campaigns was he worked for Woodrow Wilson on the Creel Commission.
Right.
Which basically, when World War I started in Europe in August 1914, the American public was opposed to any kind of involvement by I think 4-1 margin. And then Wilson, towards the beginning of 1917, or actually before that, even late 1916, if my memory serves me correctly, hired Bernays and some other people, which is part of the Creel Commission, which basically was, in effect, a propaganda agency of the Wilson administration to turn public opinion away from opposition to entering World War One on the side of the British and the French to actually support for World War One. And by April 1917, the United States entered World War One with 3-1 support of the American people. And how that happened, you know, is within a year, 1 year period of time, how you're able to change 80% of the population opposed to 75% in favor. I mean, that's the fascinating part to me.
Yeah, they didn't even have really cool digital red, white, and blue eagle graphics either, like we have on all the news now. And by the way, I don't know if we inadvertently tied Bernays to the Ludlow massacre, but that was actually one of his Creole Commission colleagues, Ivy Ledbetter Lee.
Okay,
is the person who did that.
Okay, and that was like right before the Creole Commission, correct? Because Ludlow was in 1913, and
yeah, that probably would be.
And the campaign to sway public opinion for World War I was in about 1916.
I have something right here that goes right along with this. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this propaganda is such a quotable book. It's like almost every paragraph has something almost scary sounding. Like, you know, we have to have these sort of platonic enlightened leaders, you know, telling us what to do, and he's providing the means for which them. It's not so much to sway the masses. But he's saying here that they should create a Secretary of Public Relations as a member of the President's Cabinet. The function of this official should be to correctly interpret America's aims and ideals throughout the world and to keep the citizens of this country in touch with governmental activities and the reasons which prompt them. He would, in short, interpret the people to the government, blah, blah, blah. Ours must be a leadership democracy administered by the intelligent minority who know how to regiment and guide the masses.
Yes.
As this government by propaganda, call it, if you prefer, government by education. But education in the academic sense of the word is not sufficient. It must be enlightened expert propaganda through the creation of circumstances, through the high spotting of significant events, and the dramatization of important issues. The statesman of the future will thus be enabled to focus the public mind on crucial points of policy and regiment a vast heterogeneous mass of voters to clear understanding and intelligent action.
Uh-huh.
You see, you have to fix people,
mm-hmm.
and the government must fix people.
Yeah. Another quote here I got from Bernays is, if we understand the mechanism and motives of the group mind, it is not possible to control and regimate the masses according to our will without their knowing about it. The recent practice of propaganda has proved that it is possible, at least up to a certain point and within certain limits. And he called the scientific technique of opinion molding the engineering of consent.
Yeah, and he also there's also the crystallization of opinion. He's got a book titled that. Okay, now here, I mentioned public interest liberalism and how we're members of different publics and how the propagandist must appeal to you as members of these publics. Let me see, where was I going with this? So what happens is there's various publics that are contending for their position, you know, business versus labor, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. And what you need to do, the only way you can govern this chaos is through propaganda, as we had described here.
Mm-hmm.
And on that level, now there's a lot of talk about him being so influenced by Freud.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think the reason he's not influenced, it's not like he talks about toilet training or bases anything on that, which I always thought was rather bizarre. I think a lot of Freud says more about Freud than it does anybody else.
He was a pioneer. He was one of the first, so you got to take
it. The whole basic idea of that, you have all of these unconscious things going on.
Yes.
That is what Bernays pursued.
On the emotional level more than the logic level.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. And this is why I am saying that we have no free will, especially in this madly propagandized society. And I mean, on my own personal level, in my daily activity, I assume that I do.
Uh-huh.
But I do realize underneath that I'm being influenced continually, and a lot of it is voluntary influence, things that I'm looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like you were saying about the World War, the change in the attitude about then. Look at the changes of things that have happened in recent years and how they've come about. For example, in the late 1990s, I believe that labor was on the cusp of a breakthrough in the United States.
Yes.
And then Bush got elected. 9/11.
No, he didn't get elected.
he got
appointed.
Inserted.
Yes.
9/11 happens. Next thing, everything's red, white, and blue, eagle graphics, and really wild, scary music on all the news broadcasts, and it's over and over and over.
And the color alerts.
Right.
Be afraid, be very afraid.
Yeah.
But go shopping. Make sure you go shopping, yeah. Even though you're afraid.
But it's like, you just can't escape it, but... And then he would do these things that were, so loosely connected. He goes into this great big thing about music rooms.
Music rooms, huh?
Yeah, he convinced, like, all these architects to start designing all these houses that were starting to be built for the middle class with music rooms.
Okay.
So the piano manufacturers would sell more piano. Well, I mean, you know, what are those? A lot of them are the guy's den.
Yeah.
You know, they're they're not music rooms. They're not any pianos in them. And a similar thing, he convinced these people to design. You might notice a lot of houses from the 30s, maybe 40s, where they'll have sort of these built-in kind of shelves sort of into to the wall, you know?
Yes, yes.
And they all have little knickknacks on them. Well, that was to sell books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, like, I don't think Bernays was a real genius. And neither was he a horrible person, but he wasn't, according to his daughter, that cool of a dad. In fact, even though she's a very accomplished woman, a PhD, published books and all of that, it's taken her until middle age to shake him telling her that she was just stupid.
Oh, wow. You know, one of Bernays' favorite techniques for manipulating public opinion was the indirect use of, quote, third-party authorities.
Yes,
to
plead
his client causes. Like he says here, if you can influence the leaders, either with or without their conscious cooperation, you automatically influence the group which they sway. He said an example of this was in order to promote sales of bacon, he conducted a survey of physicians and reported the recommendation that people eat heavy breakfasts. He sent the results of the survey of the 5,000 physicians he selected, along with publicity touting bacon and eggs as an ideal heavy breakfast and superior for health to the then traditional breakfast of tea or coffee and toast.
4 out of 5 doctors.
Yeah. How many times have we heard that on commercials? 4 out of 5 dentists recommend.
Lucky strike.
Well, that's interesting about dentists. He also worked promoting to get fluoride, I guess, promotion of fluoride for the aluminum industry, which I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, that's one of the big things about the fluoride conspiracy is people are saying that fluoride's not good for you, but it's just that the aluminum industry needs to do something with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I really don't know. But if he was involved in that, he did a pretty good job on getting that sold, that's for sure.
Yeah, and also said that another one of his techniques was to promote, he said, promote the fear and play with the public's emotions of it. Now, we saw that big time with after the 9/11 event.
And, you know, everybody's new Hitler. And these things have worked, and the reason I think they work, I don't think they work because of any specific, you know, real psychological reason. I think they work just because you just keep beating people over the head with them over and over and over and over.
Information. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people have said, you know, when the internet first came about, it's like, oh, this is going to change everything as far as advancing, you know, society and civilization, because people are going to have all this access to this information, but I haven't seen that happen.
Well, no, what you see
I've seen the opposite.
I spend a lot of time debunking misinformation,
mm-hmm.
you know, with people. Now, we do have to realize that, especially this comes out really good in the movie Century of the Self.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, the title of that movie is what had happened over the 20th century as we had been turned through these appeals to us as consumers and citizens and so on and so forth, and using these base emotions and sending these messages constantly. It started becoming we're more inward oriented, more thinking just of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 70s, well, maybe starting in the possibly in the 50s through the 70s and so on, sort of the new age human potential stuff came up.
Oh, yes.
And this is where Adam Curtis explains quite a bit in Century of the Self. And what happened there? Well, you know, the Army ads were be all that you can be.
Yeah.
You deserve a break today.
Uh-huh.
They started studying, going to the woo kind of places like the Esalen Institute and all this and that, which ironically is at the time, this is sort of the thing that happened to the military with the men who stare at goats.
Oh, yeah. That was an interesting movie.
Yeah. There's also a good documentaries on that on YouTube by the guy who wrote the book.
Okay. Yeah, I said here, too, in the 1930s, his Dixie Cup campaign was designed to convince consumers that only disposable cups were sanitary. You know, I remember when I was a kid in the 1960s when my parents finally bought some Dixie Cups and a little dispenser. I just thought it was so cool, you know.
Well, right now, that's paralleled by the campaign in recent decades to switch people from tap water to bottled water.
Oh, yeah. The comedian Lewis Black has a great comedic rant on the whole thing about water and the whole bottled water and that thing.
Probably have to be heavily edited.
Yes, indeed. But anyway, you know, real quick here, since we're running out of time, one of the more sinister, than some of the other stuff that Bernays did was his campaign against the democratically elected government of Guatemala in 1954.
Arbenz?
Yes, and it said that Bernays' most extreme political propaganda activities are said to be conducted on behalf of the multinational corporation United Fruit Company, which is today's Chiquita Brands. The U.S. government basically helped United Fruit Company, U.S. government to facilitate the violent overthrow of the democratically elected president of Guatemala, Abrens. Anyway, I guess Bernays' propaganda document, the BBC documentary, The Century of the Self, he branded Abrenz as communist. This all was published in major U.S. media. And according to a book review by John Stauber and Sheldon Rampton of Larry Tye's biography of Bernays, the father of Spin, the term banana republic actually originated in reference to United Fruit's domination of corrupt governments in Guatemala. And that was one of the things Bernays did of very, very... how should I say, almost evil, addition to some of the other stuff,
Well, my biggest gist of all this is also the more new agey stuff we're seeing right now, which was, the self-actualization type of advertising, Maslow's hierarchy and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
All of it is tending... I think it's really been destroying people's minds in many ways. If you look back at say like the letters of the Civil War guys that they wrote, and they wrote out in longhand and they couldn't edit, and they're like these almost like fantastic little pieces of literature, compared to what you're going to see on Twitter or Facebook usually. And the ideas, all the studies that keep coming out that show that people, if you have confront them, well, I don't want to say confront, but expose them to to facts and logic that refutes what they believe, they just believe what they believe more.
Yeah. And also it seems like various techniques of manipulation, public relations, propaganda, however you want to call it, that basically go towards the emotions, people's fears, people's desires, is more powerful than someone trying to rationally communicate information.
Well, and I've saw somebody recently, I can't remember now who it was, but mentioned the anti-Enlightenment.
The anti-Enlightenment?
I mean, but just look at what's happened over since Bernays' time when it comes to people. We were the industrial nation.
Mm-hmm.
We had the factories. We had facts. We had logic. We were down to earth. We were manipulating matter. And then as it goes on and you start hitting and all these things start coming in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, and it gets more into the woo.
What's the woo?
The woo is whatever just really appeal. The woo is the...
Is it like the id in 40
No, the woo is just pseudo stuff, like pseudo science and things like that.
Okay.
And all this.
Okay.
And I mean, I know quite a bit about it. I studied it quite a bit. I've been studying conspiracies and the New Age stuff since for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when you had to really work to get it. And now everybody's just got it. It's right there on the internet. The next thing you know, it's the Illuminati's doing this, and Kanye West is the head of the Illuminati.
not to say that real conspiracies don't exist with the wealthy and powerful, as if they don't ever talk to each other.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have Bilderberg, you have 9/11, you have the Kennedy assassination, maybe some other things.
Mm-hmm.
But chemtrails, give me a break.
Okay.
I self-edited there.
Okay.
But that's what I'm saying is that I think that what's happened is this has tended, this appeal to emotions, mm-hmm. and then later on appeal to the self-actualization desire of people have created just